English Listening Comprehension Test, Spring 2013, Advanced Level. This test is in five parts. Part 5 has separate directions. In parts 1, 2, 3, and 4, you will answer the questions asked in the booklet by choosing the best alternative answer according to what you have heard. Mark each answer on the optical answer sheet. The test is about to begin. Now you will hear part 1 twice. First, listen to it straight through.
We're very fortunate to have Melissa Hamilton speak to us this morning. Miss Hamilton is soloist with the Royal Ballet. She's 25 and comes from Dromore near Belfast. Now let's listen to her tell us about how her career started.
Ballet is seen as a hobby in Northern Ireland, an alternative to gymnastics or the Girls' Brigade, and my parents wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer. Actually, my sister's an architect. They knew I was academically gifted, but I wanted to be a ballerina. I started going to classes when I was 4, and at 16 I auditioned for ballet schools in England. But I'd been doing just one class a week, which is nothing compared to what most dancers have done at that age, and the Royal Ballet School turned me down. But I was accepted by Elmhurst in Birmingham, which offered me a scholarship, so I went there for 2 years. But it just wasn't working for me. There was one teacher I really liked, Masha Mukhamadov, but she was moving to Athens because her husband was going to run the Greek National Ballet. I asked if she'd be willing to teach me privately if I moved to Athens. She thought I was crazy, but agreed to coach me privately, for free, if my parents paid for the studio hire. 10 months later, I won the Youth America Grand Prix, after which I sent Monica Mason, the director of the Royal Ballet, a DVD of my work, and she invited me to come and take a class. And that's how I got a job here. Working in the ballet, you're constantly aware of the strains it puts on your body, every morning when you wake up and every night when you can barely stand. But we have massage, physio, and painkillers. And the feeling after a show makes it all worthwhile. But ballet isn't really a job, though. It's a vocation, like an addiction. You have to give it everything and sacrifice your soul. But when you lose yourself in a performance or achieve something you've been striving hard for, it feels worth all the hardships. It's like a drug.
Now listen to the same talk in three sections. Look at questions 1 and 2.
We're very fortunate to have Melissa Hamilton speak to us this morning. Miss Hamilton is soloist with the Royal Ballet. She's 25 and comes from Dromore near Belfast. Now let's listen to her tell us about how her career started.
Ballet is seen as a hobby in Northern Ireland, an alternative to gymnastics or the Girls' Brigade, and my parents wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer. Actually, my sister's an architect. They knew I was academically gifted, but I wanted to be a ballerina. I started going to classes when I was 4, and at 16 I auditioned for ballet schools in England. But I'd been doing just one class a week, which is nothing compared to what most dancers have done at that age, and the Royal Ballet School turned me down.
Answer questions 1 and 2, then look at questions 3 and 4.
but I was accepted by Elmhurst in Birmingham, which offered me a scholarship. So I went there for 2 years. But it just wasn't working for me. There was one teacher I really liked, Masha Mukhamadov, but she was moving to Athens because her husband was going to run the Greek National Ballet. I asked if she'd be willing to teach me privately if I moved to Athens. She thought I was crazy, but agreed to coach me privately, for free, if my parents paid for the studio hire. 10 months later, I won the Youth America Grand Prix, after which I sent Monica Mason, the director of the Royal Ballet, a DVD of my work, and she invited me to come and take a class. And that's how I got a job here.
Answer questions 3 and 4. Look at question 5.
Working in the ballet, you're constantly aware of the strains it puts on your body, every morning when you wake up and every night when you can barely stand. But we have massage, physio, and painkillers. And the feeling after a show makes it all worthwhile. But ballet isn't really a job, though. It's a vocation, like an addiction. You have to give it everything and sacrifice your soul. When you lose yourself in a performance or achieve something you've been striving hard for, it feels worth all the hardships. It's like a drug.
Answer question 5. This is the second part of the test. You will hear this part twice. Listen to this part straight through.
Hello, this is Radio 4 with your host, Nick Collins. In the studio today, I have Laura McGrath from Consumer Direct, the National Consumer Advice Service. Good to see you, Laura.
Thanks, Nick.
We have an interesting topic today, a government decision, a decision that will actually affect the lives of everyone in Britain.
Yes, this has broad-reaching outcomes.
Could you get us started, Laura?
Certainly, Nick. Well, last week the government announced greater collaboration between the National Health Service and private healthcare companies. This would allow drug firms more freedom to run clinical trials in state hospitals.
But this, as we know, has led to concern among privacy campaigners. They argue that confidential data about patients is not the government's to give.
But to counteract this assertion, 7 of Britain's most eminent scientists have written a letter to the Daily Telegraph. They claim that allowing the use of medical data will lead to breakthroughs.
Yes, this is a group of leading experts. Together, they hold 5 knighthoods and the reins to some of the country's oldest and most respected scientific institutions.
And in their letter, they wrote that access to patients' medical information and the involvement of commercial companies is vital in the drive for new treatments for diseases, things like diabetes and cancer. They wrote, and I read, quote, "In the past, UK researchers have used patient data to demonstrate the link between smoking and cancer and to understand more about the origins of disease. Discoveries made in laboratories, such as penicillin and targeted cancer treatments, cannot be translated into effective treatments without commercial sector involvement." End of quote.
You know, Laura, the experts acknowledge that patient data should be treated with respect. And they said that the option to opt out of research must remain with the patients. And nevertheless, they said that offering researchers access to public health service information could give them a powerful tool. And this would assist them in understanding disease patterns across large populations and so allow them to lessen their impact.
Yes, that's what they're claiming, Nick. And, actually, Professor Sir John Tuke, he's president of the Academy of Medical Sciences and the first signature on the letter, he said in an interview that people want better access to drugs faster. So, it's just like you said, that drugs would lessen the impact of disease, and that progress is going to be aided by better access to data on disease patterns. Again, just as you stated. So that backs up your interpretation of the letter.
But the critique is very real and surely must be taken into consideration. First, the letter by the expert states, and just a bit too glibly, I think, that current proposals should and do appear to facilitate research within the existing safeguards. That's a direct quote from the letter. Well, we know that government laptops have recently been left on trains at Waterloo, and CDs with millions of names on them have ended up in rubbish bins.
Yes, that's what's happening. Furthermore, who is funding these so-called leading experts? What pharmaceutical company boards are they on? These seven writers are clearly implicated in this business. But above all, we'd better read the small print, because there is certain to be a watertight get-out clause when things go wrong.
On the other hand, the current privacy rules mean that researchers who want to investigate rare conditions have to overcome enormous barriers to carry out this vital research. For example, scientists are hoping to develop osteoporosis treatments by investigating a rare condition that results in extremely strong bones. It affects just one in 900 people. And they would need to ask permission from 90,000 patients simply to find a group of 100 to study.
Well, Nick, we know that current therapies for diseases, like cancer, do take a so-called shotgun approach based on how they affect patients on average. And we can certainly hope that more research could help scientists determine which treatments are most likely to work with which groups of people. For example, better access to data could help researchers discover the side effects of drugs and of variation in cases of disease, and understand how that happens.
And that's important information. Thank you, Laura, for talking with me about this complex issue.
Now listen to the same discussion in five sections. Look at questions 6 and 7.
Hello, this is Radio 4 with your host, Nick Collins. In the studio today, I have Laura McGrath from Consumer Direct, the National Consumer Advice Service. Good to see you, Laura.
Thanks, Nick.
We have an interesting topic today, a government decision, a decision that will actually affect the lives of everyone in Britain.
Yes, this has broad-reaching outcomes.
Could you get us started, Laura?
Certainly, Nick. Well, last week the government announced greater collaboration between the National Health Service and private healthcare companies. This would allow drug firms more freedom to run clinical trials in state hospitals.
But this, as we know, has led to concern among privacy campaigners. They argue that confidential data about patients is not the government's to give.
But to counteract this assertion, seven of Britain's most eminent scientists have written a letter to the Daily Telegraph. They claim that allowing the use of medical data will lead to breakthroughs.
Answer questions 6 and 7, then look at questions 8 and 9.
Yes, this is a group of leading experts. Together they hold 5 knighthoods and the reins to some of the country's oldest and most respected scientific institutions.
And in their letter, they wrote that access to patients' medical information and the involvement of commercial companies is vital in the drive for new treatments for diseases, things like diabetes and cancer. They wrote, and I read, quote, "In the past, UK researchers have used patient data to demonstrate the link between smoking and cancer and to understand more about the origins of disease. Discoveries made in laboratories, such as penicillin and targeted cancer treatments, cannot be translated into effective treatments without commercial sector involvement." End of quote.
Answer questions 8 and 9. Look at questions 10 and 11.
You know, Laura, the experts acknowledge that patient data should be treated with respect, and they said that the option to opt out of research must remain with the patients. And nevertheless, they said that offering researchers access to public health service information could give them a powerful tool, and this would assist them in understanding disease patterns across large populations, and so allow them to lessen their impact.
Yes, that's what they're claiming, Nick. And actually, Professor Sir John Tuke, he's president of the Academy of Medical Sciences and the first signature on the letter, he said in an interview that people want better access to drugs faster. So it's just like you said, that drugs would lessen the impact of disease, and that progress is going to be aided by better access to data on disease patterns. Again, just as you stated. So that backs up your interpretation of the letter.
Answer questions 10 and 11, then look at questions 12 and 13.
But the critique is very real and surely must be taken into consideration. First, the letter by the expert states, and just a bit too glibly, I think, that current proposals should and do appear to facilitate research within the existing safeguards. That's a direct quote from the letter. Well, we know that government laptops have recently been left on trains at Waterloo, and CDs with millions of names on them have ended up in rubbish bins.
Yes, that's what's happening. Furthermore, who is funding these so-called leading experts? What pharmaceutical company boards are they on? These 7 writers are clearly implicated in this business. But above all, we'd better read the small print, because there is certain to be a watertight get-out clause when things go wrong.
Answer questions 12 and 13. Look at questions 14 and 15.
On the other hand, the current privacy rules mean that researchers who want to investigate rare conditions have to overcome enormous barriers to carry out this vital research. For example, scientists are hoping to develop osteoporosis treatments by investigating a rare condition that results in extremely strong bones. It affects just 1 in 900 people. And they would need to ask permission from 90,000 patients simply to find a group of 100 to study.
Well, Nick, we know that current therapies for diseases, like cancer, do take a so-called shotgun approach based on how they affect patients on average. And we can certainly hope that more research could help scientists determine which treatments are most likely to work with which groups of people. For example, better access to data could help researchers discover the side effects of drugs and of variation in cases of disease, and understand how that happens.
And that's important information. Thank you, Laura, for talking with me about this complex issue.
Answer questions 14 and 15. This is the third part of the test. In this part, you will hear 5 short dialogues. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 16.
Have you heard that police in Brazil are investigating an unusual theft?
No. Can't say that I have.
Well, 55 tons of corn were removed from a train.
What's special about that?
You see, a police report says the thieves greased the train tracks, making the wheels of the 54-wagon locomotive skid and slow down, so they could drive a truck beside it and lift the sacks of corn off.
That sounds like something out of the Wild West.
Answer question 16, then look at question 17.
Jeffrey, did you read on the internet that there's just a bit of a problem with the Carbrook Golf Course in Brisbane, Australia?
Yeah, I read that one. 2 years ago, the Logan River overflowed onto this golf course and bull sharks got into the lake there. And when the river went back down, they were stuck in the lake right in the middle of the golf course.
So golfers better not hit their balls into the lake?
No, and retrieving them is completely forbidden. There are yellow signs all around the lake.
And you can regularly see some shark fins in the lake breaking the surface.
Well, you'd better hope for a hole-in-one if you play there.
Answer question 17. Look at question 18.
I love you, Anne.
Oh, you just made my heart stop for a second. I love you too, Jim.
Wait. With your medical issues, do you only mean that figuratively?
Figuratively. Skip a beat would probably have been more appropriate.
Yes, that would have been much more suitable. Don't scare me like that.
Answer question 18, then look at question 19.
So, John, are you telling me that Susan has broken up with you?
Yes, Mum, and I've no idea why. She just left, won't answer her mobile or anything. I just don't seem to have any luck with women.
Well, John, if there's anything I can do to help you find a new girlfriend, let me know. And, well, for one thing, you should put your dirty dishes in the dishwasher. You'd get a really nice girlfriend if your place just wasn't so unattractive and you weren't so inconsiderate.
Yes, Mum. I'll try to remember what you've told me.
Answer question 19. Look at question 20.
Did you hear on the radio that a man got into trouble for driving to the police station?
No, I didn't. How can you get into trouble dealing with the police?
Well, he drove to the police station to ask to get back his license. He had lost it for drunk driving. He went up to the desk to ask for his license back, but the officer on duty noticed he was intoxicated again. And he was immediately arrested for a blood alcohol level far above the legal limit. He was more than five times over the legal limit for driving. So now he's facing charges of drunk driving as well as driving without a license.
Some people never learn.
Answer question 20. This is the fourth part of the test. In this part, you will hear five short dialogues. You will hear each of them once only. Look at question 21.
This new washing powder is supposed to clean your clothes in cold water. And you don't even need to rinse them.
Are you quite sure?
Yes, that's what the ad says.
Answer question 21. Look at question 22.
That's Stephen. He's not really been acting very wisely for, say, about the last year.
I know. Ever since he quit hanging out with us and took up with that group of lowlifes, well, it's not a pretty thing to watch.
Yeah, I know. And I'd have to advise Stephen to be more careful of what he's doing. He has no idea what he's up against.
No, he doesn't. That group he's hanging around with now is notorious. They've made all sorts of threats against various people.
And he just brushes it off. Doesn't seem to care a bit.
Answer question 22, then look at question 23.
Sally is really something. She simply won't stick to business in her own department.
I'll say. Last week she was giving unwanted advice to the accounting section, and the week before she tried to go over her own boss's head on a rather big decision. It's absolutely unheard of.
Have you heard that she's now received an official reprimand from the board of directors?
Answer question 23. Look at question 24.
Did you read the story about the student demonstration on the university webpage this morning?
Yes, I did. And you'd think they'd have gotten it right. They said that thousands of university students were complaining about the new restrictions on free speech.
And you and I saw that demonstration yesterday. We know that there were only 20 or 30 students there. I remember we counted them up.
Answer question 24, then look at question 25.
My husband's been working just terrible hours. He's exhausted.
Really? Why's that?
Because of the recent storms we've had. He's an electrical power line technician. There are trees on the electric lines everywhere. He's been on call about 20 hours a day for the last 5 days.
That's awful. He must be dead tired. Has he made it home at all?
Well, until last night he came home, showered, and grabbed a couple of hours of rest. Then he would get back up and go back to it.
I hope he doesn't collapse. What happened last night?
Answer question 25. This is the fifth part of the test. There are 5 sections. Each section is a separate piece of news. You will hear each section once, and then you will have time to answer that section. Then you will go on to the next section. You will write in Finnish or Swedish. You must write your answers on the special answer sheet. Read question A. Question A, listen to this section and then answer the question.
A butcher's shop employee accidentally handed an elderly customer a bag containing more than 2,000 euros in cold cash, rather than the paper bag of sausages she usually gets. The owner of the butcher's shop had packed the day's takings in a paper bag and placed it, as he usually does, next to the cash register. The employee mistook it for the customer's sausages and accidentally handed her the package. The honest pensioner who returned it got a 100 euro reward from the butcher and a free basket of sausages.
Read question B. Question B, listen to this section and then answer the question.
One of the nation's most widely planted crops, a genetically engineered corn plant that makes its own insecticide, may be losing its ability to kill a major pest. When it was introduced in 2003, the corn seemed like the answer to farmers' dreams. It would allow growers to bring in large harvests using fewer chemicals because the corn naturally produces a toxin that poisons western corn rootworms, a terrible pest. But over the last few summers, rootworms have feasted on the roots of this hybrid corn. This suggests that some of the insects are becoming resistant to the crop's pest-fighting powers. Scientists say the problem could be the result of farmers who've planted this corn year after year in the same fields, against their advice. Some farmers have abandoned rotation because they have grain contracts with ethanol producers for fuel.
Read question C. Question C. Listen to this section and then answer the question.
The Smurfs are blue-skinned cartoon characters created by the Belgian artist Peo. Rare original drawings of the Smurfs are set to bring up to €120,000 each in the first auction of the late artist's work next Saturday. It's the first time Peo's family has sold original Smurf artwork. Earlier on, some drawings given as gifts have been sold. Smurfs, or Strumpfs as they are called in French, have achieved worldwide fame. Peo came up with the word Strumpf over a meal when he forgot the word for salt in French and asked a friend to pass him the Strumpf. The highlight of the sale at the auction house will be a black and white sketch, The Smurfs and the Magic Flute.
Read question D. Question D. Listen to this section and then answer the question.
A giant saltwater crocodile named Elvis charged at an Australian reptile park worker. The worker, George Collett, was tending to the lawn in Elvis's enclosure. The 1,100-pound crocodile lunged out of its lagoon at George, who blocked the creature with his mower. The croc got his jaws around the top of the mower and took it underwater with him. Then George lured Elvis to the opposite end of the lagoon with a helping of kangaroo meat, while another worker plunged into the water. Before grabbing the mower, however, he had to search the bottom of the lagoon for 2 3-inch teeth Elvis lost during the encounter. He quickly found them and escaped from the pool, unharmed and with the mower. George said finding the teeth was critical, as they really stop up the drain system. Elvis has a history of crankiness and has lunged at staff before.
Read question E. Question E. Listen to this section and then answer the question.
A Houston, Texas man has told authorities he wants to clear his conscience and pay a $1 parking ticket he received 60 years ago. Dale Crawford of Houston, Texas, sent a letter to city officials after finding the ticket among some keepsakes from his late father. He says that he wants to pay the debt, even though it is a small, almost unnoticeable amount. Mr. Crawford received the ticket the day he joined the U.S. Army. He left his 1946 Cadillac at a parking meter, but because his father was late retrieving the car, it had been ticketed. Houston Mayor Anise Parker says she will personally accept Mr. Crawford's payment tomorrow and thank him for setting an example for others who owe debts to the city.
This is the end of the test. You will now have 8 minutes in which to blacken with a pencil the ovals indicating your answers and to check the written answers. Remember to make sure you have written the following information on your answer sheet: your name and number, and the name and number of your school. In addition, make sure that the information needed for the exam has been carefully marked in. Thank you.